were happy to see them die and were helped the slaughter to continue. Then the family of Esau ran back to their mountain stronghold and smugly congratulated themselves on how secure they were, thinking to themselves, what happened to the people of Jerusalem will never happen to them. Now that's quite a family story, isn't it? Okay, and the background to this is really, really important. You think your family's dysfunctional. I mean, this family's really, really dysfunctional. This is best described as a very messed up family. In fact, when you think about it, when you look into it, and I've thought about this a lot through the years as I've hit more and more family problems as I get older and our family gets bigger and, you know, and more diverse and all of this kind of thing. Every single family situation in the Bible is a dysfunctional situation. There's no exception. Even God's own line of people from Adam to Jesus is totally dysfunctional. And yet God works in the most amazing way through this dysfunction and through them. So, be secure. Be confident in God. You may be a mess. Your family may be a mess. Your life may not be all that you dreamed and hoped it would be, but God is working. And He is working in a most amazing way because, as Mike said in his communion so brilliantly, He wants to refine you. He wants to shape you. He wants to create something of the character of Jesus within you, and that doesn't come whilst you're going through easy times. It comes through hardship and it comes through suffering, and that's what makes us spiritually mature. I have 3 points today, and the first one is the danger of self-reliance. The danger of self-reliance. Let's read in Obadiah chapter 1 then. The vision of Obadiah, this is what the Sovereign Lord says about Edom. We have heard a message from the Lord. An envoy was sent to the nations to say, rise, let us go against her for battle. See, I will make you small among the nations. You will be utterly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you. You who live in the clefts on the rocks and make your home on the heights. You say to yourself, who can bring me down to the ground? Though you soar like the eagle and make your nest amongst the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves come to you, if robbers in the night, oh, what a disaster awaits you. Would they not steal only as much as they wanted? If grape pickers came to you, would they not leave a few grapes? But how Esau will be ransacked, his hidden treasures pillaged. All your allies will force you to the border. Your friends will deceive and overpower you. Those who eat your bread will set a trap for you, but you will not detect it. In that day, declares the Lord, will I not destroy the wise men in Edom, those of understanding in the mountains of Esau? Your warriors, Teman, will be terrified, and everyone in Esau's mountains will be cut down in slaughter. Now, before I get into this, today's message is a message of hope. It's not a great start, is it? They are strong words. The Edomites seriously underestimated God. That's the point. You know, the message was the pride of your heart has deceived you. You who live in the clefts of the rocks and all these things that make you feel secure, you who say to yourself, who can bring me down to the ground, though you soar like an eagle and make your nest among the stars, and there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. The first message that Obadiah wanted to get across to the Edomites was that God would see to it that they would find themselves in the same situation that the people of Judah had been in. The day would come when the nations around them would break through their defenses and reduce them to rubble. The scenes that they laughed over during Jerusalem's destruction would be replayed in their own streets. Kind of reminds me of when I was a kid, and sometimes my brother would get into trouble. I was more clever about my naughtiness. I could conceal it and I could get away with things and I could shift the blame. And I would always gloat when one of my brothers would get into trouble. And my mum always used to say to me, "You'll be laughing on the other side of your face." And I never really figured out what that meant. But this gloating thing, she was onto it. And that's kind of what's happening here. This overconfident, this cocky attitude that we can so easily develop will get us in the end. You don't have to gloat to be cocky. You don't have to gloat to be self-reliant. You can just subtly think that you're better than somebody else. You can just subtly think, "I know what I'm doing." In a slightly humorous way, we did this father and son event at Laser Mayhem a few weeks ago. Laser Mayhem is a bit like paintball, but it's with laser tags. And we mixed the dads and the sons up, so many of the sons were on the opposite team to their dad, and we had some dads on both sides. So I was on one team, my son Joel was on the other, but there were other dads on that team, and we kind of mixed it up like that. And we got organized into teams, and I looked at our team, and I was totally, totally confident. We had Ben Whitworth on our team. He's a military man. He knows what he's doing. We had Ed Tucker on our team. He has military experience. He knows what he's doing. We had great leaders such as Tony Cameron on our team. And I thought, you know what? We are going to crank this. We are going to make this work. We're going to win so easily. And we organized ourselves. And I thought, you know what? We look much more strategically astute than the other team. We really do. And we won the first game. And we won it pretty comfortably, I felt. I thought that was good. And so I was patting myself on the back because I kind of initiated the start of that game. And I thought I organized the guys well. And I thought, yeah, we won the first game. But it was the best of six. And we lost every other game. We lost the remaining five games. As we were getting changed, at the end, I heard Marcus Cameron, who was on the other team, talk to his dad, Tony, on my team, in a very interesting way. He said, "So, Dad, what did you learn from that?" Yeah, it made me laugh, too. I still sore from losing, but it made me laugh. And it was a great question. I wondered if there was a spiritual lesson in there. So later on, once I'd stopped licking my wounds, I asked the other team what they did, and they said, "Oh, after the first game, which you won, we just asked the instructors. We figured out that they run several sessions a day, so they would have seen it all, and they would know the best tactics, and we just did what they told us to do." Now, there's a lesson in humility there, isn't there? We were full of our ability and our expertise, and we were leaning on our own understanding, and frankly, during the mission briefing, everyone and his dog had their opinion about how we should do this, but the other team quietly just listened to the instructors and of those who knew better and carried out the tactics that they suggested, and we were completely, completely slaughtered and annihilated. This is probably, talking personally now, this is probably my biggest struggle in my spiritual life. I think I am wise. I think I know how to handle life. I think I understand spiritual things. I like the way that my life works and the way that I do things, and I don't like people interfering with that and messing with my, what do they call it in that film, my groove, the Emperor's New Groove. Anybody see that? I don't like people messing with that. And because I think I know what I'm doing, and yet time and again, God throws some chaos my way to show me actually I'm not as awesome as I think I am. Now, there's an easy way to learn this. You can, the Bible says, we can humble ourselves. Okay, so we can put on the clothing of humility, even though we may not be naturally humble, and we can ask. And we can go to God first, and we can ask our brothers and sisters, and those particularly who are perhaps more mature than us in the faith, and we can receive counsel from them, and we can actually avoid a lot of the pain that we might experience if we don't do that. That's not my natural mindset. My natural mindset is to be proud and think that I know what I'm doing. So then God has to sometimes grab my attention and throw some chaos my way, which gets me thinking about my pride and thinking about my self-sufficiency. Now, I'm talking about myself now. I don't know what it's like for you. I guess I'm not the only one that has that struggle. Well, maybe I am, and I'm just weird. Now I have this reputation, which I'm very proud of, not in a good way, and it's that I organize brilliant camps. Teen camp, pre-teen camp, father and son retreat, mother and daughter weekend, which is coming up. And I organize 5-6 of them a year. I've been doing it now for 17 years, something like that. It's a long time. So that's many camps I've organized. I've been given, quite reluctantly, the title the King of Camp, which doesn't sound too good, does it? I think it's not my favorite title. But anyway, I kind of like the reputation that I have, and I kind of feel confident in that. And, you know, and people say, you know, Barry, you always do amazing camps, and they're real life-changing events, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. Well, we just had a father and son retreat recently, and, or actually we didn't have one, but I'm going to come to that. I have a template which I work to and organize, and I have I've perfected over the last 16 or 17 years of doing this, and I provisionally booked the father and son retreat June, beginning of June this year, or whenever it was, a few weeks ago, in November last year, which about, you know, that's about right. I provisionally booked it. But I learned over the years that I can take a lot of shortcuts when the pressure is on, and usually I manage pressure pretty well. I mean, I have a good, goodness knows, God sent a lot of it my way over the years, but maybe I should have done the England job. You know, I can shoulder pressure well. I mean, that's one of my strengths, generally. And I usually know when to take shortcuts and when not to take shortcuts and all of this kind of thing. And anyway, the point is this. I'm going to get to it in a second. And normally I would speak to the venue about a month ahead of the event and just organize final details with them. Okay, normally that's what I do, and then if there are any problems, I can usually iron them out, and even if there's a problem with a venue and we have to move venues, I can usually bail something out at that point. I didn't do that this year because we had quite a few things going on in our family, and you know, I could have asked for help, and I didn't ask for help. How absurd is that? I don't know if you've ever done that. Probably not. It's probably only me that does that. And I left it 2 days before the event to phone the venue. Because I know the venue, I know how they work, I know how they operate, I know the facilities, I have a plan, I have a backup plan, it's all going to be fine. 2 days before, I'll phone them up. And so I phoned the venue, and the venue said, Mr. Lamb, you don't have a booking. I was stunned. They said, yeah, we sent you an email several months ago, at the beginning of the year actually, and we need to close this weekend, and we offered you some alternative dates, but you never got back to us. And we assumed you weren't going to progress the booking. It was only ever a provisional booking. And I checked, and sure enough, I'd opened the email but left it in my inbox thinking I'll deal with it later. And the date was January or February or something like that. It had been my inbox the whole time. I hadn't looked at it again. And I had people coming from all over the country the next day, or 2 days later. And in fact, even from overseas, there was a dad coming from Amsterdam with his two sons who'd booked his flight and paid for his flight and was really looking forward to this great father and son retreat. He'd heard my reputation. He'd heard the reputation of the London camps. His boys were built up. They were ready. Gosh, did I have to make some phone calls. And my pride was battered once I realized what had happened, and for almost an hour I just froze. I couldn't do anything. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. I felt stupid. I wondered if I would get fired. You know, lots of things went through my mind. And then eventually I phoned Paul Rowden, and Paul, it was just good to hear the voice of someone who I know cares about me for a few minutes. And me and Paul have a great relationship. We meet every week nearly and put the world to rights and put each other to rights. And I trust Paul a lot. And he also pays my salary, so that kind of helps. So anyway, after talking with Paul, the thing is, I'm so often like the guy in Matthew 8 and Luke 9 who responds to Jesus' call, come follow me, with first let me go bury my father. It's how I handle my challenges. Let me take care of business first, and then I will pray. That I view my problems so easily as something that I need to fix and not something that is a spiritual problem at its root and needs laying before God and understanding my heart in the presence of God. And the rest of that day felt like the longest day as I battled with my self-sufficiency, my pride, my sense of knowing what I'm doing. And I was clearly in a situation that I didn't know what to do. And my instinct was to sort it out, but to be honest, I was in a situation where I couldn't sort it out. All I could do was wrestle with it, and I spent more time praying than trying to fix stuff and make it good. That was a real blessing to me. It taught me something that day. And in the end, God came through. He enabled us to deliver an event that met so many needs. It was a Laser Mayhem thing that I just shared about. And it was meaningful. And even if it wasn't all that we hoped it would be, but the lesson was once again, as it so often is for me, lean on me and not your own understanding. Don't lean on your own wisdom. Don't lean on your own talents. I gave you those talents. You know, that kind of thing. The point is about our self-reliance and pride, or thinking that we know better. It's a dangerous place for us to be. It will come crashing down at some point. We don't know when, but we are storing up trouble for ourselves if we do not take things to God first and allow other people to give a spiritual counsel who maybe have a more objective and a more spiritually mature perspective than we do. The challenge is this. Are you ready for this? Put yourself under constant surrender to God's will. God's will in this context is not circumstantial. It's not about whether you go to this city. You know, sometimes you hear, oh, I think it might be God's will that I move to Aberdeen or somewhere. Yeah, maybe. I don't think God's that bothered about those kind of decisions, take this job or do that thing. In fact, that's hardly God's will at all. We are given free will to exercise with those choices. Some of them are wiser than others. I appreciate Mike's integrity. I wasn't going to take a job in the betting industry. That's a wisdom decision. That's not necessarily sin, but it affected his conscience. And it's a wisdom decision. To move to a city where there's no church is not the best practice. It's not necessarily sin, but it's a wisdom decision. But anyway, I'm going slightly off point. Some of those things are wiser than others, but always God will work with those. And if you make an spiritually unwise decision, he'll put you through hardship and to bring you back. And that's kind of what happens. But God's will is our moral obedience to his way of doing things, to living under his sovereignty and to do life his way and not ours. Remember the Lord's Prayer, your will be done, your kingdom come. How's your prayer life? Does it reflect your will or does it reflect his will? Are you asserting your kingdom or are you asserting his kingdom? Is that what you're wrestling with in your prayer life? How is it? How's your decision making? The same questions apply. Are you making decisions that say these are morally right decisions in the will of God, or these are decisions that I want to make that I think God will be fine with? There's a difference. Decision making is the most spiritual act that we engage in. It's really, really important that we think about that. What would Jesus do is a, it's not just a, you know, yes it is a kind of, in some ways it's just one of those kind of religious sayings, it's a little bit twee, but actually it's not a bad question to ask. But you have to know him to act in an honest way and with integrity before that. You have to know the scriptures. So are you wrestling with what the Bible says? Are you obeying what it says? How are you doing in that? What does your spouse think about that if you have one? What do your kids think if you have kids? What do your friends think? Do you invite counseling? Do you help one another to a better spiritual place? I appreciate my daughter Georgia. I don't know if it was after this Friday's lesson or maybe a couple of weeks ago when Charles Elikiu was here. And she just, we're on the journey home from church in the car, and she said, you know what, we don't really have non-Christians over to dinner. We haven't done that for a long time. And I defended it, and I said, well, usually I go out to study the Bible with people. We have family over, they're non-Christians. We reach out to our neighbors, they don't come in the house, but we, you know, we have a neighborhood where everybody talks to each other, and blah, 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 blah. And we've had other people over, and then suddenly I realized what I was saying. I think, okay, Georgia, you're right. We need to do better at that. We need to do better at that. But we need to be able to give counsel to one another, and we need to be able to be discerning with the will of God and the moral obedience that we have to be under. Okay, so that was the first point. I hope I'm doing okay for time. This hit on the head has lost my sense of timing. My timing sensor has gone. Actually, it's already gone. I mean, if you've heard me preach before, you know that. Okay, so the second point is related, and it actually rhymes with the first point, and it is the violence of silence. The violence of silence. Pick up in verse 10. Because of the violence against your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame. You will be destroyed forever. On the day you stood aloof, while strangers carried off his wealth, and foreigners entered his gates, and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. You should not gloat over your brother in the day of his misfortune, nor rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their destruction, nor boast so much in the day of trouble. You should not march through the gates of my people in the day of their disaster, nor gloat over them in their calamity in the day of their disaster, nor seize their wealth in the day of their disaster. You should not wait at the crossroads to cut down their fugitives, nor hand over their survivors in the day of their trouble. Obadiah justified the coming judgment on Edom by reminding them of their pride and violence against the people of Jerusalem. The Edomites had helped the enemy destroy their own relatives. They're like, but we didn't do anything. Exactly. That's the problem. Verse 11, on that day you stood aloof while strangers carried off his wealth. Their relatives, their spiritual relatives in this dysfunctional family. Kind of reminds me of the verse in James 4:17. If anyone then knows the good they ought to do but doesn't do it, sins. God has a problem with people who should know better. Jesus had the biggest difficulty with his earthly ministry was dealing with religious good people who were just religious good people and really did nothing. Neutrality is sin. In Matthew 12:30, Jesus says, if we are not with him, then we are automatically against him. Proverbs 18:19 says, one who is slack in his work is brother to one who destroys. Matthew 25:31-46, Jesus makes it very clear that if we're not living like the good Samaritan, then we cannot ultimately get to heaven. Paul in Acts 20:26-27 said that being free from being responsible for the blood of lost souls was to preach the whole will of God to them. Therefore, neutrality towards others with physical or spiritual needs in the kingdom or not in the kingdom is great sin towards God. You cannot be passive and be a Christian. You cannot. You cannot just come to church and not do anything about your daily lives and call yourself a Christian. Well, actually you can. Many people do. Now, if we're all really honest, we have times like that. God is gracious. God is compassionate. God is patient, incredibly, incredibly patient. But that should not be the drift or the pattern of our lives. A couple of weeks ago, a brother, quite a young Christian, asked me if he could have a private chat with me. He'd observed some attitude issues with one of my children. And it was really hard for him to bring it up. And really hard for me to hear it, quite frankly. But I'm glad he did, and I'm sure he's glad he did. It takes courage. It takes faith to have those kind of conversations, but it's totally worth it. I appreciate Obi. Obi did a great sermon last week. You know, it's fantastic. But do you know what else I appreciate about him? Was the other week he noticed that I was distracted. It happens to me a lot, doesn't it? During the worship. And wasn't my usual self. So he brought it up. But the way he brought it up was really, really great. He was direct. He was frank. But he was gentle. And he was very, very respectful. And he asked questions like, was I okay? Is there anything on my mind? And we ended up having quite a deep talk. And it was really, really helpful. I think we both benefited from that conversation. You know, it's easy for me to get defensive in a situation like that by putting a positive spin on things. The problem with that is that it doesn't really convey the reality of the situation, and the personal people that are trying to help you grow spiritually are then powerless, because if they're not dealing with reality, they're not really dealing with anything useful. It's about as good as hiring a couple of private detectives and getting them to follow each other. You're just going to go round and round in circles. I mean, I saw this letter complaining about how rail fares have rocketed over the last few years and have rocketed through the stratosphere, but it ended with the positive comment that the penalty for pulling the emergency cord is still £50, the same it was in 1972. Now that's what I call value for money. Okay, maybe it was more sarcasm, but the issue it was is what needs to be on the table, not the positive spin, not the flowery religious language, not sarcasm or humor that deflects it, but the plain, honest truth. And that's what we need to deal with each other in this fellowship. Challenge. Speak up. Say something. Make it easy for others to say something to you. Invite honest counsel from your brothers and sisters. Choose people who are going to tell you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear. Proverbs 27 verse 6. Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. We all need to be told sometimes we're awesome. Okay? And I know that. I'm not dismissing that. We all need positive encouragement, positive strokes. But we do need that to be seasoned with salt that tells us and confronts us with who we really are. It's really important. Do it this week. All right? You okay with that? Tough luck if you're not, because I said it. I'm coming after you. Okay, third point. God's unfailing boomerang. Okay, it doesn't rhyme. I looked up in a rhyming dictionary, I got alliance, appliance, compliance, or defiance, and none of them quite worked. I guess boomerang's a kind of appliance, in that the device is used to do a particular job. But anyway, I don't care that it doesn't rhyme, it's not that important. Okay? So God's unfailing boomerang, this is the last point you'll be pleased to know. I know some of you are now drifting off again and getting distracted. Are you okay? You still with me? Good, okay. Verse 15, okay, the day of the Lord is near for all nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return on your own head. Just like this morning when I hit a glass shelf in my bathroom. Imagine this boomerang coming back at you. Okay, that's a boomerang and hitting you on the head. Just as you drank on my holy hill, so all nations will drink continually. They will drink and drink and be as if they had never been. But on Mount Zion will be deliverance. It will be holy, and Jacob will possess his inheritance. Jacob will be a fire and Joseph a flame. Esau will be stubble, and they will set him on fire and destroy him. There will be no survivors from Esau. The Lord has spoken. People from the Negev will occupy the mountains of Esau, and people from the foothills will possess the land of the Philistines. They will occupy the fields of Ephraim and Samaria, and Benjamin will possess Gilead. This company of Israelite exiles who are in Canaan will possess the land as far as Zarephath. The exiles from Jerusalem who are in Sephardad will possess the towns of the Negev. Deliverers will go up on Mount Zion to govern the mountains of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. Okay, so as dreadful and terrible as the invasion of surrounding nations would be, Edom would face even greater judgment when they stood before the Lord. In that day, no one from Edom would survive to enjoy the blessing of God's kingdom. The family of Jacob would be delivered from their judgment, but Edom would not survive that. According to Obadiah's prophecy, the nation of Edom would be destroyed forever. They would be wiped off of the map in verse 10. And by 100 AD, approximately 700 years later, they had indeed disappeared. No longer on the map. Never again on the map. A whole nation wiped out. The day of the Lord is near for all nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your own head. God's unfailing boomerang. Sometimes it takes a really, really long time to come back and hit you. What you send out, though, will come back. Maybe not even in your lifetime, but it will affect your children. But I bet some things will happen in your lifetime that are a result of what you've done in this lifetime. It's not so much that the sins of a nation or an individual get to a certain point where God decides, okay, that's enough grace, it's time to teach them a lesson and punish them. That's kind of how we are as earthly parents, isn't it, a little bit sometimes. But that's not how God operates. It's more often that our sin reaches a point that the destruction is self-induced. There are consequences to our actions. When we sin and continue to do things our way over God's way, it starts to affect our hearts. And things happen as a result of our actions, and somehow life gets more difficult, it gets more complicated, it gets more frustrating, and sin is carrying within itself its own seeds of destruction. When the seeds are fully grown, it ends in spiritual death, but also along the way is a trail of carnage in life. It's like a time bomb that Satan has given us to play with. It doesn't actually look like a time bomb, because it's disguised as something appealing, something especially designed by Satan to attract us and to want to hold on to the time bomb. And so he calls it something else. He calls it something that's going to meet our needs. And so we grab it and we hold it, and we're holding this time bomb thing. And so here's the first thing that Satan says is going to meet all our deepest needs and thirst. It's yours. You hold it. He designed it for you. And he went to the trouble of tailoring it to the things that you're attracted to. But he didn't tell you that it has a fuse, or how long that fuse is. It may go quickly, it may go slowly, but it will go. And there will be warning signs that you're holding a bomb. Things will happen, but all the time your eyes and your heart are fixed on this thing that's supposed to meet your needs, and you refuse to accept that it's a bomb, and it's going to go off, and not only destroy you, but also cause damage to those standing near you, your family, your friends, maybe others that are close by. God's unfailing boomerang. What you send out will come back. You will reap what you sow. We really do reap what we sow, but it works in a positive way as well as a negative way. Remember I shared in when I did the Jonah sermon a few weeks ago about John Flynn. Some of us remember John Flynn. He used to be a brother in the church, left the church in 2004, I think. He's a blind guy, and he used to be a member here. And I saw him on the street, and I was in a rush, and I walked past him, and I justified it by thinking, you know what, he won't see me, so it's okay. I remember I shared that with you, and it really plagued my conscience And I was so gutted about that, and I asked around the fellowship and couldn't get his number because I wanted to call him and explain what happened. But then I saw him one evening at Woodford Station, just as I was on my way to study the Bible with somebody. And we had a conversation. We had a great conversation. I told him what I did, and I apologized. And he was so gracious. I mean, he was so incredibly gracious. It was moving. And you know, I didn't know until a couple of days later that Harry Mangan had been praying that week specifically that I would meet him. That was so awesome. I was so excited about that. I appreciate Andy Azzillo's sermon the other week when he talked about men going into their caves when things get tough. I could relate to that. And Nancy, once again, I think probably in the service, she commented to me that my cave is looking more like an actual physical cave. Okay, I have this office downstairs in the garage. We have a 3-story house, and on the ground floor, basically, is my office. Actually, we've just moved Georgia down onto the ground floor. But it's not just an office though; it's my music studio. So it's piled up with equipment, and actually, my desk. There's a big wall behind my desk. And so if you come in, it actually looks like I'm in a cave. And that's kind of what I do. I retreat. I don't generally deal with things head on. And sometimes I need processing time because I'm not the fastest of thinkers. I'm a deep thinker, but I'm not a fast thinker. But sometimes I just want to run away. Okay? And so that's where I go. And I might doodle around on one of the synthesizers or play my saxophone or, something like that. And that's my kind of escape. But anyway, now Nancy comes and joins me in the cave when things get tough. I appreciate my wife. She's awesome. You don't want to know about our family. You do know about our family life. We've shared it plenty of times, but it's chaos. And she comes and joins me in there, and it's okay to have cave moments, okay? But we have to embrace reality and deal with what's out there. My ex-wife, I was married before I was a Christian and divorced, Jem's mum, died recently. She was 47. She had an aneurysm and a brain hemorrhage. And it was sudden, obviously, and a very deep shock to us. And I didn't know how to handle it. It was surreal almost. I didn't know how to help Jem through this process and there was also my own personal grieving in the situation. And that's awkward. How do I bring that into my family life? About this woman who was once part of my life and the regrets that I feel and the sadness that I feel, and how do I do that in a way that is real and honest and healthy? How do I do that? And the thing is, usually when things get discouraging or difficult, the first thing I do after coming out of my cave is talk to my wife. Or she might come in and join me and we talk there. But because she understands me better than anybody else on this earth. But it was kind of awkward. I couldn't really do that with this one. And we have a great relationship, and but it just didn't feel quite right. And it made me realize I needed to go to God first and place my guilt, my sadness, and everything else before Him. And then I talked to a couple of brothers who knew me well and understand grieving fairly well. And it helped me get a sense of perspective. And it wasn't such a huge deal after that. And we had a couple of conversations about it, maybe 2 conversations about it. And being out of your depth is okay. It's good for you. Sometimes being there is caused directly by your sin. So God has allowed you to get there. Sometimes it's indirectly by your sin. Sometimes another person's sin puts you there. And sometimes, tough things can just happen. And you just don't know what God is trying to do. But He's doing something. And we have to trust Him with that. He wants you to become more like Jesus. And that doesn't happen without pain or suffering. I never got a spiritual revelation by watching Match of the Day. When life was going great. When things were going the way I wanted them to go. My spiritual revelations have come through suffering, have come through pain, have come through hardship, have come through difficulty. In a way, the third point or the third challenge should be the first, but the scripture doesn't flow that way. So anyway, do this first. Take a good, honest, sober look at the things that are not going well in your life. Okay? What are the ticking time bombs? Is it your family life? Your marriage? Your children? Your finances? Your sexual integrity, your personal walk with God, what are the things in your life where you potentially see trouble coming? Have the faith to do that. Have the courage to do that. We all have something. If you don't think you have something, then you're not being honest. And that's where you may need to start. Take stock of them. Ask yourself honestly why they may be drifting that way. Talk to God. Talk to your spouse if you have one. Meditate on scripture. Invite others in to help you regain a spiritual perspective. We do reap what we sow. It may be a long way off, but we will nevertheless reap it. It is God's unfailing boomerang. Our deeds will come back and hit us on the head. And the other two points are related. The danger of self-reliance. Wrestle with the will of God. Your moral obedience to God. The violence of silence. Speak up if you need to. There are no sacred cows in this fellowship. Any one of you can come up to me and say something that you observe in my life, and I will do my best to receive that gracefully and with a humble heart. And if I don't, then bring somebody else. And it's the same for any of the leaders. There are no sacred cows, and I hope it's the same for you too. I'm glad that Obi spoke up to me. I'm glad that this other brother spoke up to me. Speak up if you need to, but make it easy for others to speak up to you. You know, the great thing about our faith is not only the promise of eternity, but also, in this life, though we can so easily be faced with turmoil, with pain, with chaos, which is so often caused by the mess that is in our own hearts, there's always potential for some light to shine in a dark place. There's always potential for the hand of God to work if we're open to the battle of surrendering to Him, of wrestling with who we really are in His presence, and of our spiritual, and in the presence of our spiritual brothers and sisters. Thank you for your patience this morning, and we'll speak again soon.
Thanks so much, Barry. When Barry preaches, he's always very, very honest and humble, which makes it very easy for all of us to see ourselves in what he says. And you know, he asks, am I the only one here who thinks himself better than others and that? But we all know, yeah, we feel that. So thanks a lot, Barry. he covered many things. Barry's class is so practical. Did you believe you'd get so much out of the book of Obadiah? Is that right? This gives you maybe a template for how to read the minor prophets. You can get so much out. You can speak for 35 minutes like Barry just did today. And there's so much in there. So thanks for that, Barry. For me, obviously, my son Marcus has a good way of asking direct questions like, so Dad, what did you learn from that? You're probably wondering, so what did I answer? I was taken aback by that question, to be honest. I said, I learned one thing, I am terrible at laser mayhem. When I'd recovered myself, I said, so Marcus, what did you actually mean by that question? That's a very interesting question. And he was asking what I'd learned about the fact that we had lost all these games on the run. To which point I thought that I hadn't really thought about that. Very good. Very, very good. So how do we see ourselves? One thing I learned when I was at my last job, which is now finished, praise the Lord, is that you strive to do your best, but be comfortable with the fact that you hardly ever achieve it. you hardly ever achieve the best. And one thing I really gained from my last workplace was realizing I'm not as good as I'd like to think I am, or as I even think I am. And that's been a good humbling lesson. And that's kind of the heart of this lesson. It's so easy to think you know it, you know the answer, you feel you know the answer. Actually, it'd be really good to check with someone else and see things from their perspective. So I won't go on to too much longer, but thanks a lot, Barry. Let's have our final song now, which Obi's going to lead. Let's stand for that. Thanks again, Barry.